Weather today, highs of 19 degrees centigrade, lows of 12 degrees centigrade, a fine morning with some warm sunshine, although there is the chance of cloud and rain spreading in the afternoon.
This is the Midweek Drive Morning Edition on Siren 107.3 FM.
Excellent. Ways you could argue could be a useful theme for the head of payments at Nationwide Building Society, the tremendously talented Paul Horlock. How are you, Paul? Good morning.
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. Delighted to touch base with your good self. We've got six wonderful Midweek Drivettes in the studio. Hannah, of course, you've had a chance to read this story earlier this morning. We've shared the details about this research by Nationwide Building Society. 99% of British folk would not hesitate in returning home to collect their beloved device. Sally poured scorn on this, did you not, Sally?
Well, I'm in the 1% who would say I can live without it.
Exactly.
For the day. But as I say, I think that's... it's just not... Yeah, my phone's important to me, but it doesn't rule my life.
Okay. Claire, on the other hand, you're saying that your father, after being a sort of naysayer as far as mobile phone technology is concerned, is now very excited indeed.
I think he gets very excited about it. I mean, I think that for me, I wouldn't leave... I've left my phone just on the bed and I don't kind of go back and get it. It wouldn't be me wanting to get in touch with people that would stress me out. It would be, for example, my mum trying to get in touch with me and she'd stress out if I didn't reply or what have you, she couldn't get in touch with me. So I feel like it's the people that are kind of more addicted to their phones that make me rely on my phone.
And your father's payment?
He pays by Apple Pay all the time and he gets very excited about it.
So there we have it, a little slight smidgen. We'll talk to some of the other folk in a few moments, Paul, but some people are getting very excited about paying with their phones and saying, oh, this is great, this is wonderful. Obviously, there are other apps available, one from the Nationwide Building Society coming up, of course. But in terms of that, are we on an inexorable shift to using our portable devices to effectively make our payments?
I think so. There's definitely a movement for people to put their bank account in their pocket, and we went live yesterday with Android Pay. We had Apple Pay live last year. And I guess personally, my phone is my wallet, so I don't leave it at home because I use it all the time to make payments, and many more of our customers do. It's quite a regional difference. There are changes across the country. I think if you talk to Londoners, it's probably two-thirds of Londoners like to use their phone to make payments every day, whereas it's probably in your area, it's more like 10, 11% of people. And I think that's changing dependent on the availability to use the services to make best use of the phone.
Extraordinary. Mary, you're a Londoner. Does that chime with yourself? Do you use your mobile to pay?
No, but there is a move for contactless all the time. For like Oyster cards now, you can pay with contactless cards. So it is getting a lot more like you have a small kind of wallet now where you just touch everything rather than getting cash in hand.
A couple of weeks ago back in London, I was saying, where's the human being? I don't want to work with a machine. I just want to get a one-day travel card, for Lord's sakes. But never mind.
Well, I think that saves you getting a travel card. If you've got your phone is your travel card, it's, you know, your card's in your phone. It gives you the ability to access a number of different services without having to have different ways and different standards for doing it.
Emma Tinson in Surrey, is your phone your wallet?
I wouldn't say my phone's my wallet. I have done like online shopping on my phone and stuff before. I've got a few apps of like clothes websites that I like and stuff like that, and I have paid for things like on the internet by my phone, but I've never used like contactless payment on my phone. But I do have a contactless card, so maybe that's the next step. I understand why everyone kind of wants everything to be in one place. It's kind of that ease of access thing, having it all in your mobile phone, but it then makes it more scary if you lose your mobile phone, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. Everybody worries about security, and we wouldn't do this if it wasn't secure. And actually having the card secured in your phone is actually probably safer than physically having it in your wallet. And you can cancel it if you've lost it. You're covered if there's any fraudulent activity. But it's really about the convenience and control that it gives customers, because it gives you the ability to track really live the transactions you're undertaking, which you wouldn't get really from a card that doesn't give you that kind of information.
Convenience and control, Natasha. Does this resonate and chime with yourself?
I'm very suspicious of all technology. Mm. I'm just a
the Tasha's from Nottingham. I don't know how that goes in the scoreline.
I think I get it from my mother. My mother's allergic to technology. But just the thought of having, I think it kind of chimes in with what Emma was saying, just the thought of having like it on my phone, it would make me feel really, really kind of just nervous about taking my phone anywhere.
Arguably, it could just be a step on the way before it's actually embedded in a chip that's implanted under the skin, of course.
Well, that's often been talked about, and I don't think we're going that way. But there is wearable technology, and we went live with technology for running your account through your watch last year. And it's really what people want. We know there's lots of different demands out there, and we're providing a range of different services for customers that are really wanting to use all the technology and those that want to use more traditional methods. And we're very alive to those different requirements, and that's why we provide a number of different ways to pay.
And Hannah, from the Joys of Harwich, where do you position yourself in this argument?
Well, I like to think I could live without my phone, but I do keep it on me more, especially now at uni. Yeah. Before I came to uni, apparently I would, on average, text about 5 times a month, which is really small. And now since I come to uni, I'm like texting, messaging on Facebook. But it's mainly I use it for keeping in contact with people. So
we've talked about security, Paul, and that's obviously very much at the heart of this. But, you know, speaking as one who still likes to write the occasional check, how quaint in 20th century. Is physical money actually becoming outdated? I mean, we've got the Linkages show, of course, and I know there's obviously issues and always times about, oh, we want to pay by card, etc. I mean, is it a case of you say, no, we want to pay by our phones?
Well, I think there is a benefit for people to pay electronically in terms of the loyalty opportunities, sometimes the discount opportunities, and actually we want to bring that opportunity to our customers, and that's why we're offering these kind of services. We still offer the cash services. We offer ATMs in all our branches, and I think, you know, there are moves to move the paper to a plastic note, so it's more versatile and more hardwearing for customers. But there is a shift. I think you're starting to see a movement now to more electronic than physical payments. And I think it means it just gives customers more control and more real-time ability to manage their funds.
Sally, is it a case of you thinking, well, who would have thought it, eh? Or do you think, yeah, let's go
I'm not that old, Alex. No, I think it's a case, for me, it's a case of striking the balance. Very much in relation to the Lincolnshire show, you know, we've taken a major step forward in the last couple of years to move to e-ticketing. And more tickets are bought through our website, which is a massive move in advance. But it's striking the balance. So we will still have ATMs scattered around the showground and various people offering cash back and that sort of thing. So there is still the need for cash, but obviously the more and more we're going towards card payments or contactless and that sort of thing. But it is, you know, it's finding the balance for us, really.
Paul, do you embrace this joyfully, joyously and happily? Are you kind of Nationwide's official, yes, this is go, go, go? Or are there some moments where you think, just hold back a wee bit here?
I think I'm Nationwide's official deliverer of this technology. But we, you know, we want to do it in a safe way for our customers. And if customers want to take it slow and steady and find their way through, it's exactly what we want to help them do. And we have a site on our website all about different ways to pay to explain these things to customers, because it's never easy to make some of these decisions and feel assured, but we want to help customers do that, and we won't do anything unless it's absolutely safe for our customers. And that's why we've delivered this service yesterday in a way that is absolutely assured for customers to use.
Well, Paul, I think you've raised a whole range of issues from that point of view, not least all the generational ones, and the wearable technology is another issue that's working through that. Emma, would you like to put those last two questions to Paul Horlock, please?
Of course. Paul, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us on the programme today?
Thoroughly.
Fabulous. And would you like to join us on the programme in the future?
Of course. It's great to get a number of different views, and that's really what our customers always represent. So I think you've probably brought up a microcosm of our customer base, and that's what we're trying to work to.
You see, that's what we like to provide for Joe Lamb and the rest of the News Data Network. You see, we provide that opportunity. Some radio stations, it's just the presenter. We give you a whole, literal, as you said, a microcosm of the whole world in one.
Fantastic.
Paul Horlock, Head of Development and Head of Payments, I should say, at the Nationwide Billing Society. Many thanks indeed. We'll speak again very soon. Take care. Round of applause for Paul Horlock, please.
Thanks very much.
somebody, and you should set them free. So they say, but it sure is hard to do. Yeah, it sure is hard to do. And I know they say if they don't come back again, then it's meant to be. So they say, but those words don't pull me through, 'cause I'm still in love with you. I spend each day waiting for a miracle, but it's just you.
Oh, just say it. Just say au revoir, wiedersehen, sayonara, whatever, das vidania. The long goodbye, Paul Brady. William Sitwell's had an awful lot of challenges, Sally, since last you spoke to him on the show.
In fact,
he's been absent for several weeks, partly because his mobile phone was run over by a cyclist. He had he was halfway up a glacier at one stage, was pulled out to a meeting. There were times where actually people said, will he ever return? Hopefully he will. You know, we're going to try it one more time today. He actually did say he's ready for a triumphant return, as he said, it has to happen sometime. Okay? So we've been building the fact that he's been on the show. It has to happen. Today could be the day. Because I think, Hannah, have you spoken to William Sitwell at all as yet?
I don't think so. No. I think every time it comes up, it's like, unfortunately, we couldn't get hold of it.
This is the whole point, as you said.
I'm in constant anticipation.
This is the key point from that sort of thing. So, you know, we have his number. Everything else seems to be sorted through. He did say he's on course for a rousing return. This was a matter of, 12 hours ago.
Anything could have happened
that time.
A lot can happen in 12 hours. So we'll just see. It's a wonderful way of actually celebrating the Lincolnshire show and, of course, a whole heap of other goodies as well. Sally, quick name check, plug. Are tickets still available for Elton John? Because he's on the line, of course, in early June.
Yeah, he is. He's with us on the 10th, Friday the 10th of June. So I understand that tickets are still available through Ticketmaster, although...
Mobile phones? Sorry, I couldn't resist it.
I think there are still a few available, but certainly they've sold very, very well. So it's all very exciting. So the build up will start in the next couple of weeks for Elton John, and as I say, he's with us on the 10th of June.
Will you be in the front row, Sally?
I'll be on stage turning his pages.
Good. Yes.
You know, just in case.
Well, he's a pianist.
His notes.
He is a pianist. You know, he clearly will work through that, basically, and it's all important. And then very shortly after that, of course, we're into the event, as we said, which, I mean, I say it's the event, obviously. It's 33 days, 14 hours, 13 minutes, and 4 seconds to go. But, Hannah, Lincolnshire show, is it something which appeals to you yourself? Maybe not this year because you're in Harwich, but, you know, would you sort of consider that?
I do love shows like that. In fact, me and my younger brother are planning on going to the Suffolk show this year, because we've been for the last 2 years.
Well,
really,
Suffolk isn't that far away.
I may see you there, because I'm going to the Suffolk show for the first time this year.
It's very good. I do love it there.
Yeah.
It has been suggested we should be doing some location reports for the Suffolk show. It's a part of the show we haven't done this year. You know, we've done Great Yorkshire, obviously. We do the Lincolnshire show. We didn't do Nottingham this year, but, you know, in general, yes. So Suffolk on the list there.
Yeah.
Could be the sort of aspect we'll work through that. As we said, it's kind of almost indescribable. I mean, once you actually go through that country show thing, Natasha, of course, was actually at Countryside Links, but she kept it very quiet. She's taking photographs.
I didn't see you.
Exactly.
I was with the giant tortoises.
Oh, they were amazing. They are making a welcome return to the Lincolnshire show as well. There'll be a feature in our countryside area this year.
He's got a lot of them, that chap, actually.
Yeah, but they are just amazing. Yeah.
Not to be confused with turtles, of course.
No.
Because I thought they were teenage and mutant, but no. they were definitely there. So all about that. And we'll find out what William Sitwell's been doing and why. I think William Sitwell and Ian Lennox at Lincolnshire show. That could be an interesting one to watch. It'll come.
If you ever down, I would fall right through the ground. Couldn't make it on my own. Couldn't stay here all with me. The hurt would be new to me. If you could ever believe.
people in Britain actually suffering with epilepsy, and the number of cases continuing to rise, with a prediction of a 5.8% increase by 2022. The fact that we're now in the middle of National Epilepsy Awareness Week is vitally important, and to address the whole issues and challenges that are faced not only by sufferers from epilepsy, but also colleagues who might be working with people who have the condition, we're delighted to welcome Dr. Sarah Jarvis and, from the Epilepsy Society, Matthew Soamino. Soamimo. I knew I'd get the pronunciation wrong for that one of you. Matthew and Sarah, welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Sarah, if we can come to you to start off with from this point of view. I mean, epilepsy is one of those conditions that has been with us for considerable years and periods of time, etc. It's been described variously as a kind of a brain storm, a whole range of sort of issues from that point of view. Can you just talk us through the kind of issues that are faced with people who have epilepsy?
Well, we always forget, I think, that without electrical activity, none of us would be listening to this programme, certainly wouldn't be understanding it. In fact, none of us would be breathing. So all our brains work on electrical, tiny electrical nerve impulses, which go along all the time. All that happens in epilepsy is that those electrical electrical activity goes into overdrive. So for a short period of time, there's too much electrical activity and it's not organised. But there are lots of different kinds of seizures. The vast majority of them, of course, when people think about epilepsy, they tend to think about what we call tonic-clonic seizures, which is a generalised seizure where your level of you become unconscious and you have those abnormal movements. But there are lots of different kinds of epilepsy. The vast majority of people, somewhere between two-thirds and some figures say 4 out of 5 people who have epilepsy, can have their seizures well or completely controlled. Many of them completely controlled by taking the right medication. But I think what really worries me is that this new survey, which was done by UCB in conjunction with YouGov, it was a good survey looking at a wide variety of people, and it showed that 26% of people were concerned to work with somebody who had epilepsy, perhaps not surprisingly, because only 1 in 7 of them had ever had specific training about what to do if somebody they worked with or somebody they were with had an epileptic seizure.
Matthew, is it very much a case of ignorance and unawareness? I mean, I've worked with colleagues who have had the condition and happily sort of continued with their own work and so on. But is it that sort of uncertainty that literally makes the fear factor comes of the fore?
Yes, well, I mean, the UCB YouGov research that Sarah's mentioned highlights the fact that, you know, in the East Midlands, 80% of employees say report that they've not been offered training in order to support someone who's had a seizure in the workplace. And it's important to go back to fundamentals is, as Sarah says, two-thirds of people with epilepsy are on medications that completely control their condition. In terms of, however, the best available academic research is that 50% of people with epilepsy report problems with employment or holding down a job or getting appointed in the first place. So what this research highlights is that there are real barriers in the workplace in terms of lack of information, lack of advice and support. And if what we need to do is remove those barriers, as a number of very positive and progressive employers have done, in order to, for example, identify, are there small risks related to epilepsy in terms of particular jobs, particular occupations, like working on shift activity, working night shifts, that a manager can simply reduce? In terms of, for example, epilepsy can be, seizures can be triggered by tiredness, by a manager reducing someone's shift patterns, that risk can be reduced or eliminated. So it's these better informed managers and better informed workplaces will become better equipped to support colleagues with epilepsy. And in doing so as well, by becoming better informed, it will also eliminate their own anxiety levels as fellow employees and managers about working alongside colleagues who have epilepsy.
Sarah, from the again the facts domain, it was seen that nearly a quarter of folk in the East Midlands are unaware that epilepsy can actually be fatal, which is obviously the very serious end of the scale. Is it a case again of thinking about the work environment? I mean, avoiding flickering screens, all of the sort of standard triggers that traditionally we've come to associate with the possibility of epilepsy?
What we need to do is to adopt a personal approach. The good news is that in many respects, people in the East Midlands are very enlightened. Actually, only 15% of them are concerned about working with a colleague with epilepsy, whereas nationally, that figure is just over 26%. So we're a very enlightened bunch in the East Midlands. The fact remains that sensible precautions have to be taken. What you would need to do would be, for instance, to talk to somebody with epilepsy. They will know there are very strict requirements, for instance, in terms of driving. You may well not want to have somebody who has epilepsy operating perhaps heavy machinery, and certainly unless they fulfil very strict criteria. And they will know what their individual triggers are and what their individual criteria are. It's about having that conversation, because there are many people out there who suffer with epilepsy who have an enormous amount that they can bring to the workplace, but they're simply not being given the opportunity to do that. And that's hardly surprising if you consider that a boss might say, oh, I have to think of all my workforce. Well, again, only 17% of people say that they definitely know what to do to help somebody who is having a seizure. Why not make that 100%? It would not be difficult to do. That would take away much of the myth. That would allow us to help more of the public to understand that the majority of people who have epilepsy have well-controlled or completely controlled seizures. It would take some of the myth out of this.
Matthew, from the perspective of other areas and other institutions, I'm thinking higher education and further education and so on, from that perspective, are they well-equipped, better equipped? Are they coping with undergraduates and students who, again, might have epilepsy?
It's variable in terms of, but and this relates to a lady who's been one of our case studies in past work. You know, they're in the case of one of our case studies, she was at a college, and unfortunately she was asked to leave her course once she was diagnosed with epilepsy. So that was an adverse example in terms of other employers, in terms of, and also other institutions in higher education have sought to inform themselves and equip themselves. And one of the key things, going back to what Sarah says, is it's quite individualized. People with epilepsy are well-informed. They will understand the things that can trigger their seizures. They will understand how they can best be supported. And therefore, what we would encourage as the Epilepsy Society is for managers to have those open conversations about how they can support people with epilepsy, how they can enhance their own understanding. And in enhancing their own understanding, including recognising the quite simple things that they can do, it will take away misconceptions, myths, and some of the fears that colleagues and managers can have unnecessarily about epilepsy.
The Epilepsy Society's confidential helpline, 01494 601 400, that's 01494 601 400. Is that for people who might have just concerns, or is it just specifically for sufferers of epilepsy? Is it open for all, in essence?
Our helpline is open for all. Is people who get in contact with my colleagues on our helpline may be employers, they may be health professionals, they may be families or individuals directly affected. We cater for the breadth, that whole spectrum of needs.
And there we have it, Dr. Sarah Jarvis and William Corse from the National Epilepsy Organisation there, raising the awareness once again, a very important factor. Hannah, the time has arrived. Hopefully we're fingers crossed, after having battles with glaciers, with mobile phones being run over after just far, far, far too long without hearing the dulcet tones.
You're listening to Siren 107.3. Good morning. Time now on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for culinary class and gastronomic gorgeousness with the broadcasting legend, who is William Sitwell.
Are you back there, William? Are you back with us? Just at that sort of moment in time, you know, you think the line was actually around there.
That was like
what can we say?
He was so prepared.
We thought it was around. We were convinced he was actually there on the other line, but no, we're not even getting a sound which suggests he's gone completely. What can I say? We will try the line one more time, he says, but that's before we have to say farewell to Sally, unfortunately.
Yes, sorry.
33 days, 13 hours, 45 minutes, and 5 5 seconds
Alex,
to go.
I have to say, I find it really disconcerting for the last hour that I've sat here watching that clock go down. It's really not good.
It's okay. It's, remember,
are you sure?
As we said at the start of the programme, you get to a sort of stage whereby, in essence, time is just an illusion in any way.
Really?
So we mustn't worry unduly about that whole process. We're just trying William one more time to see
if he's still here.
A round of applause for William Sewell. Bang, oh. William, for a moment there, we thought, what was going on? So, listen, we have Emma Tinson. It's her last Thursday show for quite some time.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Yes, we got Mary Dancy, also possibly last Thursday show for quite some time. Were you right?
Maybe
next week. Hannah Brown from Harwich, who's been waiting for weeks to speak to you, good self. And, you know, finally still here with developer Natasha Armstrong, of course, who's doing wonderful things from food shows, etc. From the Linkages show, the very own lovely Sally Mundy. Hello. And Claire Margerison, still Hello. Seeking their oft-promised William Sitwell, let's find a gluten-free eclair for... So much, it's been like a snowball has been mounting up of people desperate to speak to you, William. Share with us what has been happening with your meetings, your glacier visits... And your mobile phone, which presumably now is working again.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I had an amusing row with Vodafone for some time, but I've now got a good deal for them. So I have a telephonic instrumentational device nice. With me at all times.
Very good.
I have travelled a little bit. My book has been published, so I'm quite... Well, I have copies of it. I've been just sort of, you know, poodling around, minding my own business. Well, trying to avoid local radio shows.
Sally, you know when somebody's actually written a book, what we must do, what is the written law of all broadcasters, you know, be it local, national, international, etc. We must plug the book.
We must plug the
we
book.
We must what's plug the book.
What's the book called? Exactly. Where is it? Where can we buy it from?
Well, the book is called Eggs or Anarchy, and it tells the story of how Lord Wilton, the Minister of Food, fed Britain in the Second World War. And it's a story that's never been told before. I found all of his unpublished diaries. And it's an extraordinary tale of perseverance and courage and drama. And this is a man with an amazing business brain, Fred Wilton. We're going to make him famous. And the book is called Eggs or Anarchy. The idea being that if we didn't get our eggs, the country would have starved. You know, the nation would have been disrupted. Morale would have plummeted. We would have had anarchy. We would have lost the war. So the conceit of the book is that Wilton is an unsung hero of the Second World War. Without him, we would still be enslaved.
And that's the kind of passion that William's ancestors, you know, Edith and others, would actually say, go, William, go. Go, William, go, go, go. Tragically, I haven't had a preview copy, so I can't comment other than saying it's bad. But William said, well, obviously, it's going to be a platinum read. It's going to be absolutely sensational, as sure as eggs is eggs. See what Eggs or Anarchy, again, the tale of how effectively the eggs kept... It's one for the hens around the world, I feel, as much as anything else.
One for the hen.
Yeah,
one for the hen.
Exactly. Hannah, yeah. Any questions for William? Now you've got a chance to speak to the man himself.
This history book, what led you to choose this person and that to write about?
Well, my first book that I have chatted about on your glorious show before, which was called A History of Food and 100 Recipes, I read a chapter about the Second World War, and I came across a photocopied piece of paper from... Lord Wilton's memoirs that came out in the 1950s, where he was talking about how he wanted to try and get rice out of Cairo. And he sent a man called Harold Sanderson off to get it. And anyway, the bottom line of the story is that while Wilton was preaching to Britain to not use the black market, he was tacitly consenting to people like Harold Sanderson, the head of rice in the Ministry of Food, to use the black market in places like Cairo, Alexandria, to buy goods for Britain. And there was a little quote in the book where Sanderson, he comes back from Cairo, he's got 100,000 tons of rice, and he mentions to Wilton that he used the black market in black, and Wilton says, quite how he got the rice out of Egypt, I neither wished to know nor thought to inquire. In other words, he turned a blind eye to the slightly more sort of sharky black markety dealings that his department was doing in order to keep Britain fed. And I thought, there's a story here. There's a story about how this man got food into this country using every trick in his commercial acumen. And I sort of delved deeply and discovered that there was a great story here, that his diaries were all in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, unpublished. I got hold of the Woolton family, who gave me all the family papers. So there were his wife, Maud, Lady Woolton, kept very, very clear diaries of all of her husband's activities and her own. And the family hadn't even written them. They were kept under lock and key, and the diaries themselves were bolted shut, and I had to use a pair of pliers to open them. And then I came across all sorts of fascinating correspondence between Woolton and Churchill. And so I weaved together this narrative about how this working-class guy, businessman, in his latter years about to retire, is put into the Ministry of Food and feeds Britain. And so I kind of, you know, I felt I had a bit of a scoop on my hands. So that's a short answer to your question, right?
Genius, genius. I mean, that is why he is the best editorial director John Brown Media could ever wish to actually encounter. And why, of course, Claire, you will be able to, when you go down to do your Masters at the University of Kent at Canterbury, see the William Sitwell plaque, which
obviously
says William Sitwell studied here.
And if there isn't one, I'm going to make one
there
and
you have
put it in there,
yeah,
don't you worry.
Yeah, William Sitwell was scooped out of the gutter here. you go down to the old locomotive by Westgate.
Yeah.
It's still standing. I think it's burnt down, actually. And that's where we used to hang out.
I'm going to put
But the old plaque. The old landlord, there was a wonderful man called Keith Willoughby. He was a landlord, and he ran out of money after I left university. And decided to do a bit of an insurance job and burnt the building down, and he's now in prison. But
what a wonderful institution you're going to then, Claire.
I'm excited.
If he would allow us to drink till 2 a.m., provided we promised him we'd be back at 9 o'clock to start drinking again.
That is the way.
Strangely, we don't offer that system at the University of Lincoln for either undergraduate or postgraduates. I know.
Well, today's students, they don't know they're born.
Emma, any thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, I actually have a question for you, William. A friend of mine is a chef, and she's recently, well, she's for the past year or so, she's had this her own small business on the side that she started, specialising in like baked goods and cakes and stuff. I was wondering if you were going to buy a cake or anything like that from a small business, what would you look for to kind of stand out?
God, what would I look for in this cake? Well, you know, there's a lot of people making cakes out there. But I think, actually, too many cakes are too complicated. And we just did a feature in the magazine I edit, Waitrose Food, where we were publishing, much to the dismay of my food editor, who I argued the case and won, of course, because I'm the editor, recipes, old cake recipes from the past, you know, proper traditional coffee and walnut, Victoria sponge, these sorts of things, carrot cakes. And I think that, you know, sometimes the cakes are too funky. The cupcake craze has gone bonkers. It's too fiddly. People want good old-fashioned cake with nice butter icing. So I just think, yeah, good, simple, nice cake, nice cup of coffee, nice cup of tea. I think tea is really important. I think we don't know anything about tea, really.
Hannah's brought her own tea into the studio this very day.
Yes.
Well, yeah, yeah, you see. Yeah, I mean, I was rung up by a PR for Cafe Nero yesterday asking me how could Cafe Nero improve the coffee of Britain? I said, they could shut down.
You see, it's not just Richard Fitzwilliams who can actually have controversial views here. Very good. You know, obviously, the views of our correspondents do not necessarily echo those of the station, but it's nicely put. I have to mention, of course, somebody who sends her very best wishes to your good self, who has actually been a judge on the National Pie Competition, who was with us in the studio yesterday with her bread, Linda Hewitt, of course. Linda Hewitt, food demonstrator.
Sounds yeah. Naughty Linda. Dirty Linda.
That rings with how she was yesterday, I think, yeah.
So funny.
You can see the photographs on our Facebook page, William. It's all public these days. I don't care anymore. We progress accordingly, William. It's been an extra special bonus edition, and I've got one more little request for you, good self. Can you actually wish one of our former film and television studies students, who's going to graduate wonderfully well, but he's taking his driving test today, would you like to wish Luke Terry good luck with his driving test?
Luke, careful, Luke. Steady, right. Left hand down. Stop.
It's sort of through.
Go on, Luke, you can do it.
So there you are, Emma. Job done.
I should not have told you that. He's going to kill me now.
Would you like to throw those last two questions for possibly the last time on a Thursday for yourself, Emma? To William Sidwell.
Of course. William, have you enjoyed your telephonic link with us today?
It's been glorious. It's been a magnificent return from where I'm standing.
It's been a very grand return, I think. Yeah. So would you like to come back and return once more on the programme in the future?
Well, you know, if Alex wants to try me next Thursday morning, I will be slightly tired because it'll be the morning after my book launch. But I think you know, I'll be up. I'll be ready for you. Well, the people of Lincoln deserve nothing less.
Exactly.
Exactly. Eggs or anarchy.
You'll get it now.
PPL, absolutely vital in so many ways. If you haven't heard of it, well, you will after this particular item, because, of course, we're dealing with intellectual property rights. We're dealing with the importance of music, which is vitally important. But at the same time, it's important that our musicians are looked after, and indeed the intellectual property rights of musicians are addressed as well. And in fact, only 7% of Brits surveyed by PPL correctly identified that playing music in a public space without a licence could result in an injunction, and ultimately could lead to a prison sentence or criminal record if that injunction was actually breached. To address some of the issues relating to that, we're delighted to be able to welcome ace recording artist, the fabulous Eska. Good morning, Eska. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thank you.
And the equally fabulous PPL Searle. That would be the wonderful Peter from PPL. How are you, Peter?
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Excellent. Eska, if we can come to you first and foremost, because we do an awful lot of work with musicians at all stages of existence, and you know, clearly as one of the founders of the Album of the Year, Mercury Prize winner, and so on. You've produced a whole range of things. This particular aspect, from the artist's point of view, it is important that World Intellectual Property Day is actually sort of considered and you know, seen as a vital part of that whole interrelationship between the audience, the author, yourself, and, of course, the text or the pieces of music themselves.
Yes, that's right. It's been, I think this is a really excellent opportunity for me to speak as an artist about the value of the music that I make and other artists make. Not only the creators, but also the performers as well, the people that I've had the opportunity to work with on my record. All those people that are involved, as well as the engineers and producers, all these people that are a vital part of the sounds that go out into the atmosphere and people get to enjoy.
Is it a case of, with music being so ubiquitous, we kind of get so used to kind of being able to download this, that, and all sorts of other bases, we actually forget that effectively, if this is to continue, we need to ensure that, you know, artists get their due rewards?
Yeah, I think the digital age has made that less tangible, you know, as a concept. You know, I remember poring over vinyl and looking at liner notes and reading where the music was made, who it was made by, who the players were. And I think that information not being so readily available means that I think it's easy for people to forget, actually, that there are, you know, that these wonderful sounds aren't just binary code. It's, you know, real people and real lives that make it.
Peter, I well remember the classic sort of phrase, home taping is killing music, that was accompanied by a cassette tape and a skull and crossbones from that point of view. From PPL's perspective, is it a case of ensuring that you know, you are here not only on behalf of the artists, but also to ensure the future of music throughout the 21st century?
Yeah, well, I think that the reality is that it is important that performers can earn money from the investment they make and the time they put into their performances. And in PPL's licensing, we're going along to license businesses that have chosen to enhance what they do by playing music. And the idea there is that if you're going to create a better place for your staff to work, or a better environment for your customers to come in and dwell and spend time and spend money on operation, the idea is that some of that commercial benefit should be shared with the performers and record companies that created the music in the first place. And I know that sometimes with non-physical rights that can be slightly misunderstood, but ultimately if performers aren't to get paid for essentially creating music, which is in itself a non-physical product these days, the digital world, they're not going to be able to carry on with their careers. They're not going to be able to pay for themselves. And so this is a vital part of the industry earning money. And at PPL, we paid 65,000 performers last year from the £197 million that we collected. So it's this business-to-business licensing is a very important part of the overall mix of where performers and record companies earn their money from.
Now, clearly this is going out on a radio station. All radio stations play PPL aspects and so on, quite rightly so, because of the elements within that. But that area of, again, ensuring that public spaces do actually carry a license to play music, is it best identified by ensuring you have an up-to-date sticker which actually shows this? I mean, if people are actually a bit concerned about this and they think, oh, I was in so-and-so still and they were playing so-and-so and playing some magical music by Esker, and I couldn't see whether they actually had a license. Should they actually display a sticker to say that they are fully licensed?
It would help. It's not essential to display the sticker, but a lot of businesses choose to do so. We haven't wanted to, and obviously the way in which you put your business together and how you choose to use your windows, etc. We don't impose on people having to stick a big reg PPL sticker on their door or window, but it would help. I mean, ultimately, if you're concerned that Esker's music's not being paid for, then you can contact us at PPL to say that you're in a particular store and just wanted to check to make sure that it was all covered. It's something that we work very hard with the different sectors. All the different sectors will have a trade body to help provide information. We go to trade fairs, we work with citizens advice bureaus, with trading standards. So we're just trying to get information out there. We try to do quite a bit of work with the business community to explain what's needed and try to make it as easy as possible for them to get the necessary license.
Esker, I'm thinking that maybe we could actually sort of see you turn your own musical skills to actually produce a musical item on the basis of World Intellectual Property Day. It's a possibility. World Intellectual Property Day, the musical. I think that's a challenge. Exactly.
As long as we collect the revenue from that, that'd be brilliant.
That's right. And in terms of the ways that we actually sort of progressing this, what's the best way to find it? I mean, Peter, if we come back to yourself for this, is it go to the PPL website? Is it a case of go to something else to find about World Intellectual Property Day? What are the online sources?
Yeah, and I think if you're a business and you want to make sure that you're doing the right thing in terms of your own licensing, then absolutely you can just contact us. Go into the PPL website. There's contact details there. There's information provided there, and I think that's just that would be the best way forward. And equally, as I say, that you might have your own trade body. You might, if you want to speak to someone more independent, like citizen advice bureaus. But we're very happy to speak to you and explain what's needed. We tend to have pretty low cost licensing. Most businesses are paying somewhere between about £65 and £130 a year for their annual licensing. It's not large sums of money in the scheme of things, but obviously for us licensing hundreds of thousands of businesses around the country, that money does then add up to more significant sums that we then share among the 65,000 performers that we paid last year.
Esker, clearly going to eskeronline.com is an absolutely outstanding website, and I heartily endorse that from that point of view. But the point that Peter's actually made there, actually, we're not talking huge amounts here, but each one actually does add up, and it is important, and presumably you'd want to endorse that particular line.
Yeah, I mean, all the pennies count. They really do. I'm an independent artist, and from that standpoint, really, that from that viewpoint, it really has been so beneficial to have that income stream there. It really does make a difference in the lives of creative people, definitely.
And finally, Peter, in terms of the issues relating to classical music, because sometimes folk will turn around and say, oh, well, if it's like 300 or 400 years old, the music, it's OK. We don't have to have a license for that. I mean, we still actually have to pay the musicians who are performing, don't we?
Yeah, so I think what recordings going back from 1963 onwards are protected by copyright. And obviously, even though certain classical music was written many hundreds of years ago, if there's a more recent performance put together, then someone has had to invest in that performance in terms of the studio time, putting the single or the album, this sort of the recording out. You've then got anything up to say 80 members of the orchestra to play. So yeah, it is important that with current recordings that are in copyright, that they are properly paid. And again, we work with a whole range of the orchestras very hard to make sure we've got the full performer lineups, we've got good details about the recordings. But yeah, absolutely, it's an essential part of this overall process.
Excellent, there we are. Okay, so Peter Leithan from PBL and a musician Eska, of course, talking about their own experiences with respect to performing rights and how performing rights is vitally important. Okay, the programme has taken us from Buck and J-Ro in Hawaii through Richard Fitzwilliams through Ian Lennox, one of whom, of course, liked Thor and Chris Hemsworth, the other one didn't. Okay, I'll leave it to your good self to check out the podcast if you wish. Thanks to, obviously, Dr. Sarah Jarvis from the Epilepsy Association. Greg White, by the way, will be returning next week. Thanks to William Sitwell. He did come back and return. And thanks to Sally Mundy, 33 days, 13 hours, and 40 seconds to go now before the Lincolnshire Show kicks off in earnest for 2016. Sally's had to leave to sort out, obviously, the Lincolnshire Show. She did take no more from that basis. Emma, have you enjoyed the programme from your own perspective?
I have very much so.
Excellent, that's very good. You're still staying with us, no doubt, in terms of contributions, location reports
of
and such
course,
like.
Of course, I will never leave.
And she has indeed returned The Truth Is Out There DVD, which is absolutely wonderful. And Mary, have you enjoyed your sequence?
Yes, I have, very
much. Might be back next week, of course, possibly. That was very exciting. And Hannah, what about yourself?
I've had a very good morning.
Splendid. Yes. It sort of opened up a whole range of sort of factors and lives and various other factors. Natasha?
It's been thoroughly enjoyable, thank
good.
You.
Are you around next week?
I'm back at Newark. But I might maybe but popping
possibly
in
around for some of the Wednesdays and a few other bits.
Potentially, yeah.
Potentially, exactly. And Claire?
I am back for my last shows next week.
There we are, you see. And of course, you did indeed sort of listen to the show, the Midweek Drama Audition, when you were a youngster.
I did. So it's kind of come first full
year,
circle.
Come full circle. I sorted through on that basis. It's just splendid stuff. Okay, news coming up very, very shortly from the Sky News Centre. It's been the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. Lots of great stuff coming through. Later on this evening, of course, you can check out Inspired On Air once again, which is a whole new sort of experience, and was particularly interesting this week because it features one soul who doesn't have a mobile phone and actually wrote a poem about a fly as a result of not having a mobile phone. Listen to the show. It's after 7 o'clock as well, as a whole heap of other goodies as well. We're pretty much all out of here. So thanks to the team, to Claire Margerison, Hannah Brown, Emma Tinson, Mary Dempsey, Natasha Armstrong, Sally Mundy. Tessa, obviously, still asleep, and presumably Emily as well. For that point.
Tessa's gone home.
She's gone home.
She's back in Glinton at the moment.
Well, she might have been listening.
She may.
Probably
have.
Unlikely she'll be asleep, but yeah, she might have been listening. Might be listening to the podcast. Never mind. That's great stuff from that line. And I'm filling, as you could tell, ladies. I'm filling because I think we could squeeze in a bit of music or we actually
well,
talk up to the news
we
jingle.
We can say
we
good
could...
luck to Eva because she's got her two interviews.
Yes. She's a busy bee. So.
Well, sorted through there. I was wondering what had happened to Miss McDonald, but you rightly say you're not just one interview, two interviews
yes,
today.
Yes, so. And she's fabulous. So if the people that are hiring are listening, then hire her.
She's
great.
She's amazing.
Clearly, good luck like to Eva McDonald from that online stuff, etc. So that's pretty much a wrap from the perspective of the Midweek Drive Morning Edition. It's like the longest farewell ever. It's always like
I like it.
Goodbye.
I like it.
It's all right. But we don't believe in saying goodbyes. It's so definite and harsh, really.
It's a farewell.
We say au revoir, you know, until we meet again, until our energy manages to coalesce into a sort of coalescing form and we can actually sort of step buoyantly into the future in the way that only Lincoln's first community radio station, Siren FM, can do in terms of life, the universe and various other factors as well. Okay, that's it. A one, two, three. Can we all say bye-bye?
Bye!